This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about value as a factor in mental health and specifically as a factor in suicide. And I'm joined by the CEO of the charity CALM, which stands for the Campaign Against Living Miserably. 125 people die by suicide in the UK each week, and CALM are on the front lines of the fight against this by provoking conversations, providing life-saving services, and bringing people together in a shared mission to show that life isn't always miserable and to encourage people to get support when they need it. With those notes that I've jotted down there, I'm sure you can understand straight away why I care about their work. And I don't know if I can announce anything yet, but there might be things in the future that I get to be involved with them, which is very exciting. But specifically this conversation, Simon is fascinating to talk to, and we really went the full gamut of what it is to find value in ourselves, to find value in others, what it is that hope means to both of us, and you know, that very individual level, but then also looking at across the board. In the bit actually behind the paywall, I was asking Simon about something he said on other podcasts, which is that CALM see suicide as a barometer for where society is at, meaning when those numbers go up and when those numbers go down, what questions does that raise about where society is at, how we're all looking out for each other, what direction our country or our world is going in. Big topic, but I guess can relate to, you know, how do we all mind each other? It's part of my work. It's so much of what I care about. One other thing I wanted to highlight here is this episode we recorded in December, but it is going live in January. And that can, for a host of reasons, be a pretty challenging time for people in general. And that's absolutely something I can relate to personally. So I'm glad to have this conversation now. I hope you get a lot out of it. And there's loads of resources available, which we mention at the end of the episode. So with that all said, big conversation. Delighted to have it. So please enjoy this conversation with Simon Gunning, CEO of CALM. But first,
who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hello, I'm Simon. In terms of early experiences, I'm interested in the experience that my father had and what that did to me and how that has tracked through my life, but also through the lives of people of similar age to me. I'm in my 50s and have inherited, I think, something which came from the experience of my father's generation being children after the Second World War and this absolute inability to express themselves in terms of their own happiness, in terms of the need and requirement to seek a happier life, but rather than that, stoicism and accepting your lot was your role. But then also coupled with the other side of that coin, which was the definition of yourself only as a professional, that you are defined by your job. And so he didn't have any of the language to have the kind of relationship that I have with my son, which is just lovely. We tell each other that we love each other a lot. I mean, a lot, quite a few times a day. And it's a lovely thing. And I sort of think about his experience of having a son where he was unable to get any of that, any of those, you know, drips of the good stuff in your brain. But then also I had a period where I'd had a really, really great, interesting, exciting career in media for a long, long time. And then it stopped and I could not get a job. I just couldn't. I was about 18 months. I was doing like consulting and, you know, stuff, but I had it in my head so deeply from my dad that you have to have a job. You are defined by what other people think of you in professional terms. And so that period where I could not get a job was really educational for me retrospectively. It was horrible at the time. But actually the job I did get was being CEO of CALM. And so there's something of a, you know, one door slamming shut and another weird door opening, which I never expected. I expected to go back into music or advertising or TV and then ended up doing this. So it's a very rapidly spinning revolving door that spat me out in somewhere I never expected to be.
I like that analogy. And maybe we should pause in that, the feelings around being between jobs. And so what sort of age were you at that point?
I was in my mid-40s. So, yeah, 47, something like that. And, you know, you start, I'm really interested in hope and what hope means to different people in different situations. And hope for somebody, I'm not playing a tiny violin here, but for where I was, hugely privileged. I mean, just ridiculous amount of privilege. White, middle class, professional, got a degree, you know, all those kinds of things. And when you feel like those structures of privilege aren't getting you anywhere, it's really, really retrospectively interesting, awful at the time, because my idea of that definition was gone of who I was. And between jobs, it's funny how your perspective of the future is so skewed by where you are at the present, that actually the perspective of the future, for certainly for my generation, and I hope that for other generations it won't be the case, was that this expectation of where you should be has gone, has stopped. And you don't expect that. Your brain conditions you to not think it's going to get better. And this concept of hope when you're in your mid-40s versus hope when you're 16, different things, and it's about this kind of chronological horizon. Where do you think you're going? And the concepts of hope and how that defines our definition of the near present and the near future. That I've got a 17-year-old son, and that they are the fastest growing group in history to exhibit suicidality. And we've got to dig in to understand why that is. And it is about this concept of the future being not dictated by the present and the past. But I think the concept of the future for young people is probably far more immediate. It's what am I doing next? The group that's my cohort, the concept of the future actually, as you get older, bizarrely is longer, is further away, is about what am I now? What will I be in the future? And there's a great Irish artist who sang Shane McGowan's part at his funeral, Preferred Hill in New York. Ben Hansard, his last record, it's just so beautifully titled. It's so clever. If you're middle-aged. So all that was east is west of me now.
Mm.
It's like such a beautiful little poem in one line. It's just brilliant because that's where you start to get to. You start to think all the doors that had potential to open, they're not even there now. So it's not about potentially opening those doors. It's the fact that yet there is a distinct paucity of doors. That's quite a sobering effect on you.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk, I'm reminded of two of the most meaningful things people have ever said to me on this show. First off, around privilege. So I interviewed Sophie Sarbidge, who has since passed from terminal cancer. And she started off her first ever interview with me saying, you know, I came from, in many ways, the perfect background. She'd come from a loving home. She was from a wealthy family. She'd gone to a boarding school, had an excellent education and had all these things. And she said, none of that saved me from mental illness. Mm. I'd never heard someone be so direct about that, perhaps because of those elements of kind of shame and judgment, that we understand that the way I tend to view privilege is it's easier to understand it as the things you've not experienced versus the things that you have. Like, it's really difficult to pin down and describe exactly what privilege is, but we could say, well, if you had financial privilege, you were unlikely to have ever not had food growing up, for example. Yeah. So you may not have experienced certain things, but it never means you don't experience hardship ever or mental illness.
Yeah, I think there's something really liberating in understanding that sort of inner workings of the mind, and that we as individuals are playing back our inner diet, our inner narrative wherever we go. When you're transporting your experience, your brain through a background of privilege, you have distinctions about how you view your place in the world. But it is also important to know that we are a suicide prevention organization, and suicide skews to those with less privilege. So there's a socioeconomic element about death by suicide, but not about suicidality or suicidal ideation.
Yeah. The other conversation I was reminded of was with drag queen Cheddar Gorgeous, who's very well known around the UK. I guess the world at this point, she's doing great. Yeah. And when describing their experience of depression, it was this piece around Cheddar saying that that the worst thing in many ways is the lack of hope, is that kind of hollowed out feeling of, is there anything left of me? Is there a future? And the fear, the pure fear of, what if there isn't a future?
Yeah. There are three key elements that we tried to address. One is giving people a sense of self-worth. Another is a sense of belonging to something bigger than yourself. And then helping people, as you get across that continuum of happiness, where people are right at the bad end, to try to avoid ideation shifting into volition. And we've got a brilliant head of services called Wendy Robinson, who identifies there that entrapment is a key element that shifts from ideation, which is totally normal. It's a human thing. But into volition is what we have to try to remember, that really knotty end of the continuum. And that is largely around entrapment. So financial entrapment of debt, of the relentless nature of debt that just drags you down, leads to volition, for example. And so when we're talking about privilege, there's a chance that financial privilege means that all that entrapment is less prevalent. But that's not to say that entrapment isn't just a part of, again, that human condition. And privilege aside, that the ideation into volition brought about by an absence of options is part of the human condition. So it sort of makes it a bit challenging to think how you can challenge these, how you can address these.
Yeah, but I think there's also something in that, knowing that as terrifying as suicidality is to go through, and by extension it is to even talk about in a general sense at times, there is something to that element that we're not even alone in how we go through it, that there can be elements that are familiar across different people, and therefore there are ways that we can tackle those elements. Because you're right, there is so often, you know, all these kind of factors that, as you described, take it from that place of an idea to something that becomes a plan or becomes intention.
Exactly. And that plan and that volition is quite often, it's not a long worked out process. It's impetuous. But there's something terrifying and comforting in the fact that there are 14 million people in the UK who have suicidal ideation. So that's terrifying. So it's a major, major thing. So 6,500 deaths, which is a number that Colm has been focused on alongside Samaritans and other people. And it's an awful, awful number. You just have to meet people who are, you know, have lost their child or parent or, you know, loved one. But as we come out the blunt ways of that myth, there's such a huge number of people, 14 million people who have suicidal ideation, which is living miserably, you know, the clues in the name for calm. But it also, on the flip side, says that this is a human condition. There's a guy called Professor Rory O'Connor, who's at Glasgow University, who's a really great guy, he's an academic, but he is so clear and so strong in his prevention tactic or strategy, which is talking about suicide, not talking about how you're feeling, talking about suicide as a directly preventative measure. And as such, we have to shift the social discourse. We have to get to a point where we can say, well, this is just a part of our brains. It's existentialism. We question our own place in the world and our own existence because we've got these stupid big brains. And when we can get to that point where we can have conversation, a dialogue as part of our just social interaction about suicide, because it's a normal thing. When we can get to that point, we can start to prevent it, because it's not this other people thing, it's the part of what we are, and then you can prevent it.
Yeah, I think that's so beautifully articulated, because that is in many ways the foundation of stigma, this separation of there's us and there's them, that there's something wrong, there's something substandard about somebody that goes through difficulty in their life. You know, that's what so much of this kind of boils down to in a broad way. And what if we talked about it? What would the world be then if we highlighted all the ways that we were similar, the ways that actually suicide is relatable? Is it that we don't want to look that in the eye? You know, that there's been times when we've all had that. In the same way, you know, like intrusive thoughts feel like a parallel here, where that's something that a lot of people feel they can relate to or they can't. But then I think all of us have had times when you cross a road and you realize it was just a little bit too dangerous. You nearly got hit because you missed something or you took too much of a risk, and your mind might jump to, oh, what happens if I have been hit? And it's not the same as wanting these things to happen. It's a part of the human process. It's a part of how our minds work, that we have all these ideas firing, and some make sense and some are random and don't relate to our intentions. And in the same way, it can be difficult to look those things in the eye, because we're like, what if that is something more? Maybe I'll ignore it. I think there's elements of that with suicidality, yeah, as well.
But it's such a part of that human condition. It's important to stress the calm works right across that continuum, right? So we'll work with people who are absolutely fine, always have been, and we'll help them interact with their friends and interact with their loved ones and stuff as we go across that continuum. As it starts to be expressed in ways which are really understandable, really relatable, you know, Conor Oberst, who's in a band called Bright Eyes, and he has this line, the modern world is a sight to see, it's a stimulant, it's pornography, it takes all my will not to turn it off. And I've always thought, wow, just like, that's such an interesting perspective on that, on his mission, which was then, amazingly, our patron, Ramesh Ranganathan, was doing a podcast for us with Penguin Clothing, you know, and he just had a moment where we just thought, screw it, you know, just start saying it. And he talked about when he was struggling to become a comedian, his dad was in prison, life was really horrible, and he just came out with it and said, it was really comforting to me to know that I could turn it off, that I could just find a way just to not be around this pain and this stuff. And he said he found that a comforting thing, but that's suicidal ideation, but expressed in a way, you know, I guess Conor Oberst, whose position is the struggle not to go from ideation to volition. Ramesh's perspective was that he was never going to go to volition, but that was something about his state of existential angst that actually I can exit a stage, he found comforting. And I think that when we really get these subjects out in front of people, which of course for, you know, thousands of years, Greek philosophy, you know, existentialism, it's a part of what we've talked about. And I go back to kind of my dad's experience. I don't know, but certainly all of that was shut off completely around the mid part of the 20th century for us in where I am in the UK anyway. We've got to try to unpick that, because 16 to 24 year olds are the fastest growing group in history to exhibit suicidality. And we want to stop that. We want to put a fire break on this generation that says we have to make sure that that ideation doesn't turn into permission for this group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. We can't keep seeing these numbers. So much has to change. And I want to bring in a theme here of value, because I think there's already some links maybe that we've highlighted with you talking about how often it is that people equate their value with their job and the risk of, well, then what happens if you don't have that job? What happens when the job ends? And, you know, particularly Calm has a background of working primarily with men. And I think there's a parallel there that men are still disproportionately encouraged to identify who I am is what I do for work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were gender exclusive, which sat very uncomfortably with me. It did distinguish Calm in, you know, a congested market of organizations, and had very genuine and very great motives to do that, because men are were so completely underserved and probably still are. But I felt very uncomfortable that our helpline would help somebody who wasn't identifying as male once, but would not recommend that they come back. Whereas with men, it was the principal would come back whenever you need us. So we changed that. But I think we have to think about the different experiences. So yes, for me, hugely privileged, white, middle class, yes, identifying my happiness and my place in the world purely by my job became a thing for me, rather than was where I started out with, because when I didn't have that job, that became extremely difficult. I think, though, looking at huge swathes of society who had never had a job and have never had a way that would enforce their sense of worth, their sense of belonging to something, that sense of identifying into a group, into something which is bigger than ourselves, is absent for so many people. And that's why we talk about leading a movement, because we want people to feel that if you haven't got anything, you can always put that Calm badge on and be a part of our movement.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're right, people need that, you know. And something I've heard you talk about is during the pandemic, there was this, you know, broad suspicion that suicide numbers would go up. And, you know, we were lacking the community, we were lacking connection, loneliness was in many ways at an all-time high. I'm interested in your thoughts on why the numbers didn't change in the way that many people thought.
Yeah, there was a horrible social media thing going on with this 200% increase that was just became kind of a received fact and just wasn't. It's important to stress that it's the 18th of December and the ONS numbers come out tomorrow, so we don't know where we are on the last count. Numbers dipped a little bit. There's a part of that down to access to means, because we were locked indoors and the means are quite often outdoors. So there was an element of that. We had a huge rise in use of our helpline. 97% use of our website doubled. So people were seeking help, but it didn't turn into a huge rise in suicide. There are some theories that actually for some people, this shared experience of anxiety actually gave a sense of community that wasn't around before. But there are theories being espoused that that was the case for a number of people. It's not almost the, I told you so, everything's bloody scary and I bloody told you. It's as crude as that, but is this shared experience? If you think that you're not joining in with any kind of shared experience with the rest of society, that is isolation. We also play around with...
Let's pause on that, though, because, I've had similar conversations there where I think there could be something that if, in many ways, anxiety, to use an example, can be so isolating, and then when you find yourself in a time when that feels like the public mood, that's nearly the consensus to have, not necessarily that as a condition, but elements of the feeling of anxiety, then maybe there can be something there that feels a little bit more uniting. I remember a friend of mine that has OCD relating to germs joked with me that, well, I was right. Now we know I was right all along. And, you know, she's joking because it's a condition she works with and gets support for. But, you know, I hear you on that element there, that there could be something.
It could be. I mean, certainly, I think if you're struggling with anxiety, then lockdown would have been the tide that lifts anxiety. Yeah, sure, it's lifting for everybody. But if you're already in a bad place, you know, that's going to put you into a very difficult kind of situation. But there are loads of just such interesting things that we can try to work with. One which I really like is about awe, A-W-E, rather than metal. An experience of awe of something which is so much bigger than we are that grounds us to an extent. And there was elements of awe with lockdown. The whole world stopped. Something amazing to see ourselves as a small constituent part of something much, much bigger, which is useful and is useful for us to think about now, I think, a couple of years out.
Yeah, well, definitely. I remember, you know, all the photos going around of like empty cities, and there was something kind of, it's strange to talk about in a way, but it's somewhat mesmerizing about seeing our daily lives change so much and what that looks like collectively, as much as we were also battling with, oh God, what does this mean? As well as, isn't this a little fascinating?
Yeah. Empty cities, and the fact that we had all decided to do this thing together, no doubt, even in the UK, ended up with people standing at the end of their cars banging pots.
To save the NHS, didn't it?
Yeah, of course it did. Yeah. I would suggest that funding it probably might have been another way of doing it.
You know, all good ideas.
Yeah, but if you're a nurse experiencing life-changing trauma in ill-fitting, poorly working PPE, and you're underpaid and you're working 20-hour shifts, clearly, someone banging a frying pan is going to be what you need. That's going to get me through it. But I do remember those first few times. I refused. I was just grumpily. I did actually go to the end of the path when there were lots of people banging pots, and I did suggest loudly that there is a better way of doing that. And that's perhaps voting for a party that's going to fund the NHS better. But
there were, I mean, see, yeah, it's just campaigning at any point, you know. You can't not partition.
But there was this sense, there was a weird sense of community, wasn't there? And this suspension of disbelief. Amazing. It was an incredible thing. Horrible.
Yeah, horrible, incredible. And, you know, maybe there is something there that maybe Ramesh mentioned. There can be something that we learn from really dark times in our life. And that's not that we would have chosen that, but there's something that we can take out of having these conversations and figure out where certain things we've been through fits in who we are and where we are in the world, as opposed to, I don't want to go back there, but I can learn from it how to hopefully not go back there.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. We're all too quick to forget, aren't we? Therapy is so interesting in scratching the itch you didn't know that was there. I had lunch with a really good friend of mine last week. He was a therapist and she just can't help herself. Despite the food arrives, and I just had to say to her, you're doing it. You're doing it and you can't stop bloody doing it, can you? I should have tried to psychoanalyze me. She said, I'm not. Yeah, you are. Stop it. But of course, half an hour later, really, I'm being psychoanalyzed and she can't stop herself. And it's so interesting to try to find those lessons that you didn't realize you picked up. But of course, there's permanent scar tissue that's going to change your behavior. And I've unfortunately for so many of us, do you remember what was it? Drunk or something or other. What was it? Were you going to be? I remember that there's so much of what happened that in that period that we've forgotten about. And I'm looking at my kids who both had a year at home and GCSEs cancelled and all those kinds of things. We have to be wary of what that's done to them. We have to try to scratch those itches that you don't know are there in order to try to see what that's done. So my daughter went off to university and she found the first year so hard, so isolated. And I wonder if there were ripples of what had happened to her before when she left her school where she had loads of friends and was, thinking about being a goth, which is great, by the way. She should dress like music that they like, shouldn't they? But there you go. There's a part of being something bigger than yourself, being a tribe. And she was a full-on goth because she liked The Cure and other stuff. Now she's an indie kid. And I love it that she identifies as through her music. As it, when I was a teenager, that was what you did. And then the bloody Kings of Leon came along and started dressing at River Island and ruined it all. But where are they?
I think your background in music is showing.
Talk to me about Kings of bloody Leon. Was it River Island? It would be River Island,
probably. You know, there's students teaching this, but
yeah. How can we, in the absence of, again, privileged access to therapy and those formal tools, I want people to be able to understand where they've come from in order to be able to cry, what a cliche, in order to be able to understand where they're going.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And that's why you're a CEO. Original, non-cliché. And so tell me a bit more about this work.
Sometimes we shout about death, but mostly we shout about life and view that as the, I'm not an antidote, if only it was so simple, but to really accentuate good stuff is a preventative measure. There's a thing called the Papageno effect, which is, it's a character in the Magic Flute operetta. I don't claim to be familiar with operettas, but this is the highly accepted and proven theory that whilst suicide is contagious, because it is, hope is at least as, if not more, contagious. And so telling stories of survival, we did a campaign called Stay for people who got to a point of volition and didn't and stayed or didn't complete their suicide attempt and stayed and life has got better. And that trying to enforce that principle that life can get better is fundamentally important to us. And you do that through positive reinforcement, right? You talk about the future, which can be better the way you are right now. But whilst suicide skews, 75% of deaths are male, actually attempts pretty much the same. Not with, I'm being hugely binary here. And if we go into marginalized sectors of society, then attempts and completion is much higher. But if we're talking in binary terms, then attempts are pretty much the same. It's just, it's that completion is more likely for men because we use more violent means. That's not a nice way of putting it, but it's the truth. So our work, so the way I would kind of think of it, and hopefully it doesn't come across as bombastic, is that I had no idea how to run a mental health charity. I just had no idea. And I went for a month 7 years ago. But one thing that I did enjoy or I saw as something really useful was brand. And so thinking of a brand in terms of every other, I'm looking at a Google Pixel phone, I'm looking at a Mac, I'm looking at a, what's it, what they call Chili's bottle.
Oh, they got you.
Yeah, they got me. It has to compete in this world of brand congestion and differentiate itself in order to get this message across. And that actually all we're trying to do is get people to do something they didn't expect to do, which is to stay, which is to be happy, which is to help the people around them, which is to learn the tools, like really proper tools about suicide prevention. that when, once we were equipped, we could do that, that job for ourselves and people around us. And so in that brand and that marketing terminology, we've got to use the same tricks as Google and Apple and Chili water bottles. We've got to be effective communicators. So one of the first things that we did, that I did, was to go around everybody that I knew from the advertising industry, give them what we refer to as the holy shit numbers, which is all the stuff we've been talking about with, you know, attempts and suicides and ideation. And they say, what are you going to do about it? And the first kind of big jump in our success, as you put it, we were really quite responsible. People understanding the male skew, understanding what was 84 men is now 94 men a week in the UK alone. And that was through marketing, man. That was through communication and doing a campaign called Project 84 with ITV and with one of our key agency partners, Adam and Eve. So we behaved in a way that you weren't expected to behave as a charity, especially not as a suicide prevention charity, because you meant to stay in your lane and do the things that people have always done. But if it seemed to us that actually it wasn't working and that there were huge underserved audiences at the time, male and now everybody.
Yeah. No, I really love that approach, because you're right, we are increasingly driven by brand affiliation. That idea of community has been co-opted to sell us things. And so whilst, you know, I'm absolutely just as much a part of that, like I love my Apple products, I'm here talking to you on an iPad with my notes on my iPhone, and I love that those two devices talk to each other. But, you know, there's something which is lost, I think, there. If charities don't also take on the advantages there of what if people buy into hope, yeah, and yeah, what if they buy into, you know, the positive messages that, you know, brands across the board, you know, try and sell you, that you drink Coca-Cola and it means you care about the environment. But there's also a lot of charities that maybe do a lot of that work, maybe a bit more directly than Coca-Cola giving a portion of their funds, you know?
So there's opportunity and danger. So with big brands, Coca, trying to appropriate purpose, because the audiences expect and want that from their brand affiliation, probably Apple aside, but lots of brilliant brands. Patagonia is just fantastic. And I wear a Patagonia hat because I want to identify as somebody that thinks that Patagonia is cool, because he's given it away, you know, in order to try to do some good things in the world. But there's the danger that as brands get better at that, they start to appropriate the idea of charity. And you can see it in the numbers, like it's charitable giving is about, blimey, is something like a third down in the last 2 years in the UK. And there's a danger that big brands can appropriate that. And that means that the charitable world gets left behind. But there's an opportunity as well for cars. So we partner with, I mentioned ITV, but we partner with Beavertown, BMW, and Spotify, and Netflix, and so many. Penguin, as I mentioned about Ramesh, like literally 20, 30 brands, because we can bring to the way that those brands fit in the world. And I want people to choose our partner brands over their competition because they're doing good things. And we won't allow charity washing. You can't give us some money and we'll put our logo next to yours. But if you do good, really good stuff with us that directly helps your target audience, you will be that brand is directly partnered and therefore credited with that. And so they're doing good in the world and funding Calm.
Yeah.
So it's a new world. It's a bit of a repetition from kind of 19th century corporate benevolence, which was led by Quakers, obviously, with Bourneville and Cadbury and, you know, Bourneville? No, hang on, Bourneville's a place.
Yeah. Cadbury. No, but they were based in Bourneville.
Yeah, I'm sure you used the word I was looking for. But now these Quakers, that they did it because they felt that they would look after the community around them. The position for corporates now is that actually I never thought of this, but their impetus is probably even stronger than that, because it's their customers telling them to do it. And if they don't do it, then they will fall behind. The opportunity for organizations like Calm is when we position ourselves in the minds of our supporters. We've got 60% brand recognition in the UK, and that is 100% brand recognition, 100% positive brand recognition. That put your business next to Calm and do good in the world, and you will get that association and that accreditation. So the world is changing, and the way that you do things like Calm is to behave like the world is, rather than the way it used to be.
Yeah, it's great to hear how strongly people identify with this, you know, as a positive brand and, you know, influence. And that example you gave of partnering with ITV, if people outside of the UK aren't familiar, you had created with various partners 84 statues of men and put them around the edge of ITV. And that was an incredibly powerful image to visualize. That's how many men are dying a week.
But I have a group of advisors who I can go to, technical advisors, and I was very nervous that we'd be doing harm. And we're told, no, people are aware of the fact that there are buildings in the middle of London. You're not going to get kind of copycat behavior. Also, those 84 men weren't jumping from those roofs. They were standing defiantly. And most importantly, out of all of that, the statues were made by bereaved families to represent the man that they had lost. That is fascinating. They were made out of cellotape by an artist called Mark Jenkins with the families. And the families wrote messages on them. It's so emotionally moving to see the messages that the families had written to the father, their son, their brother, the loved one. And then all the clothes that they wore were sealed with super glue. So the clothes could never be, they can't be undone. You could cut them with scissors, but you can't just open up the clothes and have a look at the messages. It was private. They were sealed. And then the statues there led to the appointment of first ever Minister for Suicide Prevention in the UK, which was our desired outcome. But perhaps more importantly, because this government scrapped the post, more importantly, it led to the biggest ever Google search for male suicide. That's what we were trying to address. And so awareness of those facts was changed by, honestly, by a marketing technique.
Yeah, there are these practical things we can do, you know, to address suicide, to fight against it. You know, I love that even the branding with Calm, it is the word fight you tend to use, because it is this thing that we're going to take action, and we're going to take action loudly and clearly against this. And that really reminds me of something that you were talking about earlier, right? That when we looked at the pandemic and there was so much concern around this idea of suicide doubling. And, you know, much of that, to my perception anyway, seemed to come from the kind of statistics you gave of a 94% increase to people reaching out to your helpline. Samaritans was also echoing a similar doubling. And there's something there that's concerning. There's also something there that's hopeful to me, that when people were feeling this more prevalently or more frequently, however you want to put it, they also knew where to go. They knew the organizations out there that can help.
Yeah. It's so that somebody said a couple of years ago that if you didn't know 999 existed, you wouldn't know what to do when your house is on fire. But if we can successfully translate that into a kind of principle that nobody's got nobody because everybody's got Calm, that's where I want to get to. I worked for a little while for Bacardi Global Brands, which was beautifully luxurious. And there's a principle around Bombay Sapphire Gin that they have, which is that they want, and they think that people that select Bombay Sapphire, when they're at the bar, they order a Bombay Sapphire and tonic rather than a gin and tonic. And they say it loudly because they wear that bottle as a badge. And that really stuck with me for what I want. But I remember the first time, probably about a year after I started, so just kind of 6 years ago, I walked past our local pub, and there was a tall, young kid, because he was in a pub, you know, he was over 18, sitting there, and he had a Calm badge on. My son saw it, and there was just somebody sitting there, might be the friend, and they're just wearing a Calm badge. And then another time, a couple of years after that, we did a thing with Topshop, R.I.P. Topshop and Topman, and I'm a football obsessive, and I went and sat down in my seat to watch Arsenal, and a kid like two rows down sat down and was wearing the T-shirt that we made with Topman that had a big Calm logo on the back. And just think, this is something so brilliant. If we can make this a movement, if people like can put it on like they would put on a Bombay Sapphire bottle, I would put on a Patagonia hat to say, that's the kind of person I am. Then if we can get our movement really into the hearts of people, that they can say, this is the kind of person I am. I'm about tolerance and community and the right for me to seek a better life. If we can make that a part of suicide prevention, and that we can also shift the narrative so that people are able to say, when somebody says, oh, what's that? What's the campaign against individually? Do you ever say, oh, it's a suicide prevention organization, without kind of dipping their voice when they come to that word, without trying to avoid that word? Well, once we get there and people are identifying and being a part of what we're trying to do, then we're much further ahead.
Yeah. If we can find our value in that, in all of that, that's what I want. And so we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for your time. If people want to reach out to Calm or even learn more about the charity.
So much stuff on our website, guides about how to deal with loads of things that might come into your life and how to help people around you. So that is there. It's deep and it's big and it's helpful and it follows our tone, which is dark and angry and supportive, kind. And then if you're worrying about yourself, you're worrying about anybody around you, 0800 58 58 58. It is, I'm afraid, only for people in the UK, but it's free to call. It's open from 5 to midnight, 7 days a week, or you can WhatsApp us and join if you don't want to talk. But what makes us unusual is that the staff and outline are paid and trained, highly trained professional people. And we are highly interventionist. We will help put plans together for you or for the person that you're worrying about. Our helpline is skewing much more towards that very difficult end of the continuum. It is a suicide and suicide prevention helpline. But get in touch with us if you need us, because we're free to call, we're confidential, and we're there.
Brilliant. And I'll just add to that, you can also visit our website, which is mentalpodcast.ie, and that gives you options all over the world of similar organisations, many of which we've worked with here on the show. So thank you again. The work is incredible. It's been a delight talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.